It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the size and shape of the sector, generative AI, and neurodiversity in the sector. It's all coming up.
Letting students know what it's likely to be like when they pitch up at their halls of residence, so they've got more advanced warning, and having spaces to go where it's quiet. These, I think, would be changes that would be good for all students. And that made me reflect on this difficult balance that needs to be struck between mainstreaming these.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to thread the needle of higher education this week are three brilliant guests as always. In East London, it's Nicola Dandridge, Professor of Practice and Higher Education Policy at University of Bristol. Nicola, your hire to the week, please.
I think it probably was chairing a panel that was judging essays to commemorate Jonathan Nichols, who was the registrar at various places in the sector and who tragically died last year. And in commemoration of him, AHUA and various groups put together a competition to invite essays to celebrate Jonathan. And we were judging the fantastic essays earlier this week. It was a really good thing to do. Some really good essays as well, actually.
Let's give them a read. Even further in East London, it's Joe Cooper, Director of People and Culture at the University of East London. Joe, your hire to the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Yeah, on Monday, I had a rare opportunity to spend an entire day with the leaders of all of our academic schools and professional services areas, talking about the progress we've made at East London and thinking about the challenges of the future. It's quite rare we get that amount of time to really kind of think about the future and spend some time with each other. It was a really rewarding day.
And don't write in. I know we're London-centric today. In North London is Debbie McVitty, editor of Wonky. Debbie, your hire to the week.
Yesterday I had one of those really fantastic meetings that you sometimes kind of manage to carve a bit of time out in your schedule to do. And I was speaking to a colleague at the University of Hull, where they're in the process of implementing a new curriculum framework, a competency-based curriculum framework. And then if you are excited about that kind of thing, as I am, these conversations where you get to sort of see what's happening on the ground and think about how universities are transforming learning and teaching, I just left really kind of feeling really, really positive about that and what's going on there. And if you want to hear more, do come to Education Espresso, our regular event on Pedagogy with Adobe on the 4th of April. More on the site.
Now, we start the week with the new shape and size of the higher education sector after some new stats come out this week. Debbie, talk us through it.
Right, so this is the HESI stats, the Higher Education Students Early Statistics, which is the in-year data that is provided about student numbers that is provided to OFS, and which has historically been submitted to the regulators so that you know, bits of funding that relate to different student groups can be allocated. So it's not the same as HESA data, which we get a year later, but it gives us a really kind of good indication of the kind of shape and size of the sector kind of in real time, based on a census that is taken on the 1st of December in the academic year. So there's lots of content on the site about this, but the kind of headlines that have come out is about the changing shape and size of the sector. So Jim and DK have pulled out some key things. One is about the kind of enormous expansion in postgraduate taught numbers. And that is, you know, lots of universities are trying to recruit postgraduate taught international students. You know, in part because of the fee freeze at undergraduate level and kind of the need to make the numbers add up. And, you know, in part for all the kind of very good reasons why you might otherwise recruit those students. But the consequence of that is that, you know, the sector is now 30% postgraduate. And that, I think that sort of raises questions about, you know, but what should be done about that? The other thing, of course, is about the kind of the rapid shift in numbers. As, you know, some providers change, you know, growing numbers very, very quickly, so other providers shrinking, and you know, and the kind of knock-on impacts on quality and so on.
Right. So, Nicola, these big swings of numbers, probably not a great surprise, given the kind of market forces and pressures on the full-time undergraduate fee in particular, but it is going to change the shape of the sector, isn't it?
Yeah, not a huge surprise, but nonetheless the scale is quite significant. And I think, you know, clearly there's nothing wrong about expansion of particularly postgraduate taught students. There's an increasing need for that degree of expertise. I think where I'd have concern is where the numbers suggest there's a huge hike in students And it then asks, it begs questions about the quality of the teaching that they're receiving. And so where you've got domestic students being replaced by postgraduates, by international students, sorry, where you've got domestic students being replaced by international students, that may not be a bad thing. It depends on the scale. And where I think we would have concerns, I would have concerns, is if the numbers are just exponentially going up very suddenly and you wonder whether the capacity is there to support them.
Mm, yeah, I mean, that capacity point is crucial, isn't it, Joe? I mean, from student support to really anything you can think of, if you're going to increase numbers of any sort that dramatically in 1 year, or frankly lose them actually in other cases, that's going to have an impact on everything that happens on campus, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Nicholas said, it's not a surprise that given the real terms value of the tuition fee and the market factors that universities have had to look at the opportunities for growth and diversification, and that's to kind of help sustainability and to kind of support quality. But there are a number of different approaches that universities have taken. If you look at the numbers, and I think David has pointed this out in his blog, there's growth in some areas with international postgraduate students. Other universities have chosen different paths in terms of going entering into third party arrangements with other providers. So whatever path is chosen, it's really crucial that it's linked to a clear strategy and it's a sustainable plan that's supported by resources, because it needs to be able to support growth in quality, not cut away, to Nicholas' point. So at the University of East London, we've thought really hard about what our strategy is. We want to be a local organisation, a local anchor, but we also want to connect that to a global education and skills ecosystem, and we've also got a really specific objective linked to that, to significantly grow the proportion of our international students. So because we've planned it, it enables us to think about capacity, to bring the right resources in to support it, and that then benefits all parts of the student community. So to do that in a planned manner is really, really important, and that really has a positive impact. On a side point, what we've seen, one of the really nice things we've seen as a result of the recent growth we've had, and certainly comparing it to the COVID days, is that you can really see the diversity and the vibrancy on the campus community. It could really add to that broad student experience. So I think this growth is for the sector is a necessity. I think there are real concerns if it's not done in a planned and managed way, but can actually lead to real benefits, not just for the students that we're bringing in, but for the more traditional students as well.
I mean, I think Joe's right. We shouldn't assume that universities aren't doing this in a planned and managed way. I don't think like the default should be, what are you trying to pull a crafty one here? Because but it is also true to say, I think, that it would be, if that was not happening, it would be quite hard to know about it. And it would be quite, before it was too late. If you think about, your average, international postgraduate taught, there's very little regulatory infrastructure around the postgraduate education anyway. There's no postgraduate NSS. There's no monitoring of outcomes. And even less so in the kind of international space. So, I suppose the question that is whether, given the kind of scale of this, it then becomes necessary to ask, to kind of almost make a presumption that how would it be appropriate to kind of be secure that all of that planning and resourcing that you would expect to happen actually is happening, and to what extent is that a necessary thing for a regulator to do?
Yeah, well, this gets to the heart of it. I mean, Nicola, OFS specifically doesn't have powers to regulate over kind of the market. It doesn't have any kind of market measures, I guess student number controls or tolerance bands or anything like that. That wasn't the intention for how OFS was set up. But do you think? But is there? Surely there's going to become a point where, the data, there's big enough change at an individual provider that, somewhere on, the mega dashboard, it starts flashing and someone at OFS says, well, maybe we need to go and have a look over there. Particularly if where a lot of this stuff happens, in franchise provision and, possibly, I think what I'm saying is it's possible even to do in providers not on the OFS register, right?
But look, there's a lot of, I think the OFS is very aware of the vulnerability of postgraduate talk, particularly students that come over for 1 year. But precisely as Debbie said, because there is no NSS for postgraduates and there's no, it's much harder to get a sense of what's going on simply because of the duration of the courses. But I think OFS is very conscious of this and it does have regulatory responsibilities for these students. So I think if there are sort of certain warning signs, like a sudden increase in postgraduate taught numbers going up, particularly from maybe one country, and it has all the powers it needs, really, to go and have a look and see what's going on. I mean, the other side of it we haven't talked about is if you've got large numbers of international students coming from one country, that's a huge sort of financial vulnerability, potential risk. And I think that's another concern that we all need to have as to whether or not the sector is setting up a financial model that's not going to be long-term sustainable.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a bit on the show in recent months as well, because the Home Office is certainly aware of what's going on, because, you know, the migration is, you know, this is reflected in the migration stats, and there are some particular countries and regions that they are worried about, and, you know, particularly where students are bringing dependents on a large scale, which is, you know, changing migration patterns in the UK quite significantly, as well as it's changing the makeup of universities. So that's latest we've heard. There's been a bit of a row about, you know, how that is going to be cracked down upon if it is. But, you know, I think that one of the things the sector's going to have to look out for, isn't it, Debbie, is government action, if not regulatory action.
Yes, and I think it's interesting that, you know, although lots of you know, shots have been fired, but no actual policy has come out of government as yet on this kind of, I guess, sort of cracking down or restrictions. I do think that the way it gets talked about is very unfortunate, because, you know, obviously international education is a really positive thing, and this is a question about sort of saying, how can we bring international students, kind of, you know, bring them here in very above board ways, close any kind of loopholes that could, you know, tempt those to take advantage of what should be a kind of open and generous system and all the rest of it. You know, this sort of language of cracking down and restriction is really just incredibly unhelpful. But I think even though the part of the problem here, though, of course, is that, you know, even if it is just saber rattling and there's no policy, the saber rattling itself is unhelpful. It poses a risk, because it poses a risk to the international reputation. It makes it very hard for universities to plan in a meaningful way. And actually, it kind of creates that sort of temptation to sort of fill your boots while the filling is good, rather than kind of, you know, make a long term kind of, you know, sustainable growth plan.
I think that's right, Debbie. And I think it also almost suggests that universities aren't thinking very carefully about this themselves. Because obviously that diversification and sustainability is absolutely fundamental to, you know, to the growth and the future of the sector. And I'd just point out, it's not a new problem either. You know, I've worked in other institutions where there have been concerns around how diverse the income streams are. I know some universities had to have a long think about their reliance on Chinese postgraduate students when COVID hit. So it is something that universities are continually thinking about. So I think you're right, the suggestion that the only solution to this, or the only people thinking about this, are the regulators or the government, is far from the truth.
I think the franchising model is quite interesting as well, and sort of can often get quite lost, because actually a lot of the franchise provision will also be international because of the nature of some of these relationships. If you're franchising in London, for example, if you're a provider that's not in London, a lot of the students that you know will be recruited will be international as well. But I think it's always been a kind of, I guess, challenge for the sector to set up the kind of deep, sustainable relationships with franchise partners that, in which that, you know, the licensing provider, as it were, is can be really, really sure that everything is sort of exactly as it should be, that quality is being delivered. You know, it continues to be, I think, an area of risk and weakness, you know, because especially if you have an awful lot of franchising partners, which is the case with some providers.
Mm. And we're told that OFS is going to look at that in more detail next year. So this is where sort of the two risks intermingle, the change in your size and shape and also your franchise position, franchise provision rather. That's going to be an interesting investigation, I would have thought. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, my name is Smita Jamdar and I'm partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. This week I've blogged for Wonky on the OFS's consultation on its approach to charging fees for investigations. As is often the case, I have no real objection to the proposal to charge fees for investigations, but I do have some problems with how the OFS has set out its approach to doing so. In particular, I don't think there's enough safeguards in the consultation to ensure that its fees are limited to what it is reasonable to recover, which is what the underpinning regulations that give it the power to recover fees require. I don't think there's enough assurance that it will only investigate as a last resort and where it's reasonably necessary to do so. And I've set out in the blog some thoughts on how the approach could be improved and made fairer. OFS will make decisions to request information or make recommendations simply to recover its fees.
Okay, it's been another massive couple of weeks for AI and its developments, leading to some soul-searching questions in higher education. Nicola, can you walk us through it?
Yeah, there's been a huge amount of interest and apprehension, actually, about the pace of development of new AI technologies, generative AI, which draw on existing databases to generate human-like content. And the thing is, this is just moving so fast. So I know Wonky podcasts have previously covered ChatGPT, but that has now been significantly upgraded by its manufacturers to the new ChatGPT-4 and eradicated a few of the blips and made it much sort of faster and more powerful. And then we've also got the Google's chatbot called Bard, which is coming on stream. I tried to get onto it, actually. There's a huge waiting list. And that hit the headlines a few weeks back, actually, when it was launched, because there was some error in the actual podcast that launched it, which caused a bit of controversy, which I think demonstrates one of the risks in these things. And then we've got Microsoft with Copilot, which is intriguing. That's going to be embedded in the Microsoft applications and will allow amazing sort of facilities to join up all the existing data and generate speeches and PowerPoints and really kind of quite amazing. Anyway, so what does all this mean for the higher education sector? Well, I mean, this has to just have a transformative effect on the curriculum, because all students, all of us, but students in particular, are going to have to know how to navigate, to be skeptical, to how to know how to use this sort of stuff. Immensely powerful, immensely positive, but it's going to require upskilling. But then, and also, it's going to enable personalization of learning. So I think, you know, real positives there. The negatives, though, and this is what's hit the headline, is the ability for students and others to use this to plagiarize in terms of their of essays and exams. And very difficult to detect that. So there's a lot of soul searching in the sector about that. And also just a capacity issue about for university staff to adapt the curriculum. And then just it's moving so fast. You know, can we keep up with this, both the positives and the negatives? I was thinking, actually, my final comment on this, that we were talking about the HESI's data. I mean, that's where facilities like Copilot would be so brilliant. You could just press a button and ask for, you know, what are the three top trends in this data set? And it comes up with it. I mean, that sort of thing will be amazing if it's reliable and not abused.
Yeah. So I think, in summary, Debbie, we've got a bit of a bulge here in terms of kind of capacity, in terms of the changes that need to be made, in terms of the kind of strategic level thinking that university is going to have to do, but possibly leading us to a very interesting place once we're through that. But I guess, you know, what's going to have to happen, you know, what does this journey look like now, where, you know, to get to the sunny uplands?
Oh, I mean, I think part of the sort of I suspect that a lot of kind of higher education colleagues sort of feel like I feel about it, which is that it's I really, really want to feel like I'm across it, and I feel like I'm not across it, and that is a bit scary, particularly for someone who kind of his job is relates to being about being across things. I think there's going to have to be a bit of a kind of, you know, we all just need to educate ourselves on what it can do. And then we need to think really, really carefully about what that means in practice, because a lot of the things that it can do right now, so like, for example, I think, you know, I asked ChatGPT-3 a few weeks ago, tell me about the kind of, you know, the key developments in technology enhanced learning. And it spat out, you know, an extremely sort of, I guess, extremely pedestrian. Had I been being assessed on, you know, if I was using it for an essay, you know, it would not have given me a kind of, you know, a high quality answer, you know, evidencing kind of independent creative thought. But if I was writing a university policy that said, you know, what do we need to make sure that, you know, what are the boxes that we need to make sure we've ticked in this area, you know, where we're kind of thinking about this, that would actually have been really, really useful. So, you know, it's kind of, I think, taking a kind of measured approach to what are the things that we do right now, you know, as Nicholas pointed out, kind of data analysis is one too, that could really just help move us forward. What's it going to be likely to be able to do in the future? And that's where we sort of, there needs to be a bit more of a dialogue, I think, between the kind of tech futurists who are kind of in, perhaps in a little bit of a siloed conversation, particularly in higher education, where you sort of get sort of enthusiasts kind of, you know, hived off into their areas. And so that conversation is going to have to disseminate out into the kind of mainstream. And that's going to, I think, change the kind of nature of that conversation as well. And you know, and then I think it, you know, there's going to have to be quite a lot of just people kind of practicing, you know, just using the tech, and you know, so that it becomes kind of mainstream and second nature. And some of that, you know, and you know, we've seen this with other technologies. Some of this sort of happens kind of to some extent by itself, just because people start using it. And try not to panic and try and keep an open and curious mind rather than a kind of panic, you know, we must shut down, we must put up boundaries and barriers kind of approach to this.
I mean, Joe, one of the interesting things is how you know, a lot of this is going to happen unilaterally. So with, you know, Microsoft rolling Copilot into Office 365, which, you know, many, if not most universities subscribe to in some form. We talked about Bard going into Google, although that certainly looks much less developed product. The point is, it's just going to appear there, and it's going to start offering options, which could be really brilliant, like Nicholas says, in terms of, you know, let's analyze the data in the spreadsheet, make that PowerPoint presentation based on a, you know, a few bullet points, or, you know, notes of a team meeting. But I guess, you know, how when it's happening to everyone unilaterally, you know, how are we going to kind of establish the norms of practice inside the university? And, you know, what does that conversation look like?
It's a really good question. It is going to happen really quickly, and particularly the Copilot announcement, and knowing how quickly Teams got integrated into universities because it was part of the ecosystem that we use is a good example of that. And it, you know, it's moving so quickly. I actually thought last night about whether I could get ChatGPT to write my comments for this section, but then I realized that is already an old hackneyed trick that loads of people have done. That's how quickly it's moving. But I think we should take some comfort in the fact that if we sort of think about the past 20 years, nobody talks about what higher education used to be like and say, wasn't it great when you used to have to kind of search for a dusty book in the library or wait for the delivery of a journal so you could get hold of the knowledge that they need? Nobody thinks like that. If you think about how things have changed so significantly over the past 20 years, I think it gives us some comfort that the sector, students, academics are able to kind of embrace and support and make the most of the changes, although it does seem to be happening at an increasing pace. Obviously, you need to think about how it affects teaching and learning. There's some kind of really difficult questions, like, you know, would it be more effective for AI to complete the marking of assessments? Would that be quicker, and would that be more consistent? But actually, how does that affect the relationship between the assessor and or lecturers and the students? Could we be in a situation where you've got one AI detecting whether an essay has been written by a different AI? So those are really kind of complicated, weird questions that are going to come up. I think it's also going to affect how we work in professional services and support universities as well. To Nicola's point, actually, one of the things I think universities struggle with is actually taking our data, external data, and trying to make some meaning out of it and try and make sure that kind of really affects our strategic thinking. So that could have a huge effect on that. So I think, you know, it won't just affect the roles we have in the future. It'll affect how we operate. It will affect the courses we need to deliver. I think, Mark, you wrote about the fact that, you know, you can draw up a sketch of a website, and an AI can kind of deliver that for you. So we don't think we're going to need courses in web design anymore. But we also think about the skills that we need to kind of provide students with in order to succeed in the course, but also to then be employable. So we've mentioned PowerPoint. I remember when I did my MBA, a large part of that was actually how do you turn information into a presentable format, but Copilot can apparently do that now in seconds. So there are risks there, but reducing some of the effort that goes into this work does enable us to focus on knowledge development, debate, understanding the human implications of the knowledge that we become aware of, and practically applying it in the real world. So I think if we embrace those changes, it's really exciting for the sector.
I think there's something for me about the risk of homogeneity. I think one of the things that, because I think one of the ways that AI tends to work is because it looks at kind of what generally is true and then reproduces that. So, you know, when it's, you know, we could find that all of our PowerPoint presentations look very similar. All of our websites look very similar. And I think I think there's always going to be a need to understand the kind of fundament. And I think one of the things that you hear at the minute is people kind of talking about as if there's a real intelligence behind this technology, as if there's almost like, oh, I don't know how this thing knew that I was asking it this and that and that. And of course it didn't know. It was just kind of, you know, it's just ones and zeros behind it. So, we do kind of collectively need to understand what's going on behind the magic, so that when we ask it to do something, we then are empowered to reject the answer or amend the answer or update the answer, so that we are kind of able to bring some creativity to that, I think, you know. And that, you know, that's where I think it gets quite interesting in kind of, you know, what is knowledge production and you know, what is creativity, and how do we kind of develop and assess that in students.
Yeah, and the shape of the economy as well. So, you know, if you know, universities, you know, might have to think about, it's not just, are some courses redundant or not? You know, whole professions, according to the latest literature, might become redundant. Although that's also been criticised and heavily caveated. The point is, things are going to change. But universities need to be at the forefront of this. I'm excited, but I'm also nervous. I mean, you know, James, our operations person at Wonky, I mean, we're a small business and a small team, and we're actually enormously excited in terms of those things you're talking about, Joe, in terms of efficiency. We reckon that about 40% of what he does can be automated by AI and with the tools available today, which is enormously exciting, because it's not that, you know, his job's going to be replaced. It means that there's more time to do more interesting, more creative things, you know, help develop the business, you know, do more cool stuff. So it's the possibilities. They just seem almost endless.
But in some ways, it's not the people, actually. It's not students of higher education you need to worry about. It's all those people who don't go to higher education, who have traditionally done jobs that don't require an awful lot of creativity. And whether, I guess, is sort of hollowing out of the labour market, where you've got people, you know, people at one end doing very low paid, kind of very manual work, and people at the other end doing very highly paid professional creative work. And that's where I think there's, you know, we're probably going to see some negative impacts here as well.
Definitely. And yes, like any major development that happens in an unplanned, patchy way, the winners and losers and inequalities tend to get exacerbated, don't they?
Speaks to the need for more people to access higher education.
Now, we're going to talk about all of these issues in a lot more depth at an event called The Avalanche Is Here. That's on the 19th of April. Online, join us with a team of experts and commentators with talking about how AI is going to impact on higher education, and keeping this conversation going, because I think it's a really interesting one. Just the changes that are happening and the thinking going on this year. That's before you even fast forward for the next 5 years. So join us on the 19th of April for The Avalanche Is Here. And remember, don't panic. Now, there's new research into neurodiversity in higher education. Debbie, walk us through that, please.
So last week it was Neurodiversity Celebration Week. There was a report out from Unite Students exploring the needs of neurodivergent students in the transition to university, as well as while they're living in student accommodation. And it's looking at the ways that neurodivergent students sort of experience the world around them, and particularly the ways that often university systems are designed for neurotypical people. So looking at things like the environment and how that can kind of sometimes be, you know, very challenging in a sensory way for people who are autistic or have ADHD, for example. So it's really kind of, I think it's really interesting to see there's been a lot of attention to neurodiversity lately, and rightly is sort of filtering into higher education, and it's really helping, I think, neurotypical people understand the kind of the scale of the difference of how neurodiverse people experience the world around them, and that can only be helpful. And Sunday Blake from Team Monkey has written on the site about building understanding between the neurotypical and the neurodiverse. And we have also a number of colleagues from higher education writing about their own experience of neurodiversity. So there's loads of interesting stuff to dive into there.
Right, so lots here. Joe, you're a director of people. So I'm guessing this has come up at UEI. I'm just interested in what your approach is, particularly start with staff.
Yeah, well, I think reading the report, I've read it through the lens of thinking about kind of our responsibility to staff and what we need to do in order to support neurodivergent staff. And what's really interesting when you read a report like this is that it kind of synthesizes all these experiences and they're shared in a really useful way, it provides you with these insights which are really quite practical and almost quite obvious when you read them, but you hadn't really thought about them before. So I really reflected on some of the experiences in terms of the physical environment and making me think about, you know, how does a physical working environment provide the opportunities for neurodivergent staff to thrive and contribute. So part, you know, you have to think about the working environment in terms of how people work and, you know, how we plan our activities and how we communicate and how we build communities and understanding. But actually, what I read in the report were there are some really practical things, like if the working environment is noisy or if there are flashing lights or things that don't work, that can be a real barrier. So it made me really think about what we need to do about the physical working environment as well as the more broader kind of community that we look to support at UEI.
One of the things that's interesting about neurodiversity is it presents in very different ways. Even people who both have a diagnosis of ADHD, their ADHD may manifest in different ways. So, to what extent can universities kind of respond at that scale when you've got these very kind of individualistic presentations of disability in that way?
Well, one of the things that struck me about reading this report, it's a really good report, by the way, was the... as Joe said, it's sort of the practicability of many of the recommendations. And when I was reading them through, I was thinking, well, these would be good for everyone, really. So letting students know what it's likely to be like when they pitch up at their halls of residence, so they've got more advanced warning, and having spaces to go where it's quiet. These, I think, would be changes that would be good for all students. And that made me reflect on this difficult balance that needs to be struck between mainstreaming these sorts of changes so that students with different sorts of neurodiverse conditions feel comfortable and confident, but not mainstreaming to such an extent that actually the particular needs of those groups of students are obliterated. And I think that's always a challenge with different sorts of medical conditions and disabilities. How do you get the balance right between mainstreaming so it benefits everyone and it doesn't particularly draw attention to people with disabilities? And yet, how do you ensure there's a proper focus on people who have very distinct needs? And without their needs being met, they're quite vulnerable and put at a disadvantage. And I think the thing about the report is it really tries to get that balance right. But I think answering your question, Debbie, about how do you accommodate such a wide diversity of symptoms and conditions, I think the answer has to be, well, then you mainstream as many of these responses as you can to the benefit of everyone.
I think another practical thing we can consider, and I was reading Edward Mills' blog on the site. He's a lecturer with autism, and his experience is based on a late diagnosis. So some really interesting work that he's done to try and sort of present the university experience in the way that would have really helped him when he joined university, but he didn't have a diagnosis at that point. So I wonder if this work we can do around identification and diagnosis for students, so actually the sort of, universities can help them understand their own needs and communicate them effectively, not least because, and I've got some personal experience of this, we may well be receiving students who don't have an effective diagnosis, because I know that the current, certainly in my local area, the current wait for a ADHD diagnosis through the school and NHS system is 4 years, which obviously is completely pointless when you think about the important developmental stage that children are in when they're in secondary school. So we do need to kind of think about the role that we can play in helping students identify their own needs.
Absolutely. And if you are a kind of a bright student, perhaps who has not presented in the kind of traditional way, you know, you might not have been disruptive in class, for example, but then yes, the chances of you going undiagnosed are much higher. And so of course, you may be sort of showing up with the amount of extra effort that you're putting into kind of essentially masking to conform to what is seen as kind of appropriate learning behaviours maybe really really immense. And I think so much of this is coming out of the woodwork actually. And I think the other thing is really really important is to help neurotypical people understand that this is not. This isn't a fashion, you know. People aren't being fashionably, claiming to have ADHD. This is that, you know, our understanding collectively is increasing rapidly about challenges that people have been experiencing for many, many years, and it is really, really important that conversation happens with, you know, on campuses with an open mind and with a sort of. A sense that this is a very important watershed moment in progressing our collective understanding of what's going on here. And there's enormous strengths of being neurodivergent that you can bring an awful lot to the classroom situation. This is not about kind of deficits or it's about helping people overcome challenges.
I think that's absolutely right. That, you know, there's been a real shift in the discourse from what I can see recently. It's about embracing the benefits of having neurodivergence across the student and the staff community, and actually how that can really help organisations move forward, enhance the university experience for everyone taking part, as opposed to it being a deficit that the individuals in the organisation have to get past.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in the UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Nicola, Debbie, Joe and Michael Salmon that makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. In the meantime, stay wonky.